friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March the 3rd, 2020. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion introduces the seventh week of our 12-week Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This week's study is on the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we began a short 7 weeks ago with a look at the jhana method of meditation. The next week we looked at the beginning section of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is the Buddha's instructions on what to do during jhana meditation. We're first mindful of our breath and our body. And we use that that connection to our breath as an anchor towards reality. When we find that we're caught up in our feelings or thoughts and distracting reality within ourselves, we become mindful of our breath. And that basic practice, as I mentioned to Bill a little earlier, is jhana meditation. It's solely for deepening concentration, and every time we engage in both components of that method, recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening concentration. The next week we looked at the Four Noble Truths. Everything the Buddha taught was taught to understand Four Noble Truths. And I gave the very brief explanation of why they're called Noble Truths is because these are four truths that relate to the Dhamma and relate to human reality within the Dhamma. In other words, the sky is blue is a true statement. It has no meaning at all in the Dhamma, except to understand that it's a true statement. The Four Noble Truths are stress and suffering occurs, craving for and clinging to fabricated views of self in relation to the world initiates stress and suffering. The Third Noble Truth is that it's possible to end that internal process. And the Fourth Noble Truth is the truth of the path that leads to the cessation of craving for and clinging to fabricated views of self, which points us to the central theme of the Buddha's Dhamma. We went through a 36-class study of Vipassana, true introspective insight, into these things called the three marks of existence. The three marks of human existence, every human being is subject to these three marks, are the impermanence of all phenomena, a misunderstanding of self. The Pali word for that is anatta. The Pali word for impermanence is anicca. The Pali word for the misunderstanding of self is anatta. It's a grossly misunderstood and misapplied teaching, often to point to a fabricated dharma of no such thing as a self. The self is non-existent. The self is empty. The self is nothingness, and that we should strive to realize emptiness or nothingness. That's not something the Buddha taught. In fact, the Buddha did not teach that the self is nothing. He simply taught and used the term anatta to describe the misguided notion that what I think of myself actually constitutes a self. They're wrong views. When the Buddha uses the term anatta, he's simply saying the views you're holding of a self are anatta. They're not a self. They don't constitute a human being. Let go of the views. And that's the entire teaching of the Dhamma that resolves that way. All the other teachings, what we're going through in this course, what we will continue to do right here at Cross River Meditation Center, is to develop that understanding of this central theme. And that's where we are today. So I'll read the chapter, part of the chapter from the Truth of Happiness book. I'm not going to read it all, and we're only going to have two classes tonight and Saturday morning on this chapter. And one of the reasons is we had an extensive study of this over the summer. I know in the past few times we've gone through the Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, I broke this up a little bit more. And we may do 2 weeks on each, on Tuesday and Saturday, on beginning next week, but we'll see how that goes. So this statement from the Buddha, from the Anguttara Nikaya, and you hear me say this often, when you can understand these words and properly apply them, this is a complete Dhamma teaching. Be mindful of impermanence to end conceit. When impermanence is understood, it is also understood that none of this is self. None of this. A very powerful statement. What the Buddha is referring to is everything. There's nothing in the world that constitutes a self, save for six properties. The Buddha taught that every human being is made up of six properties. The four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. The space property. You need a space property for the four elements to manifest in. In other words, the space property would be my mouth or my eyes, my ears, my nose, my lungs. They're all part of the space property. I couldn't speak without a space property, could I? I couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. The space property defines the other four elements. And the sixth property is consciousness. And it's consciousness that manifests and informs the other five properties. So if that consciousness is rooted in a misunderstanding of itself in relation to the world, it will misinform itself. How could it not? Anatta. The self doesn't know what it is, doesn't know what constitutes a self. And so the Buddha realized this upon his awakening, and his whole Dhamma, again, is about understanding what a true human being is and their relationship with an always impermanent world. And from that understanding, from that profound understanding known as right view, we develop a calm and peaceful mind. Why does our minds become calm and peaceful when we're no longer involved in that conceit that the Buddha uses? Another word for conceit is eye-making.
Not distracted anymore.
But yes, because in this moment, I'm not feverishly and tenaciously trying to maintain this fabricated view of self. And there's times when that's actually terrorizing, isn't it? When you feel like you might be discovered, that people might realize you're not all that you think you are, and you're not all that you put out there. Well, that's the underlying stress that we, as human beings, put ourselves in. We create something of ourselves that we were not and cannot possibly be. And we do it with an infinite number of things. As the Buddha says, it is also understood that none of this is self. There's nothing in the world that we can point to besides ourselves and say that that's me. Yet we do it all the time by clinging to the people and events of our lives and making them mine. Even the basic misunderstanding of dukkha is something that we cling to. The Buddha often refers to the problem of dukkha is that we join with stress and suffering, which means we make an identity over the stressors in our lives. And how many times do you hear yourself saying, somebody asks you, how was your day? Well, I had a bad day. Well, you didn't have a bad day, did you? You just had a day. But when you're self-involved, when everything is a self-referential view, then you do have bad days because they're happening to you, rather than simply walking peacefully and gracefully through your own life. That's what the Buddha teaches. How to do that. How to do that in a very practical and meaningful way, and a way that can never be challenged by ignorance. In a way that can never be challenged by ignorance. Once we understand, we understand. It's the nature of ignorance to require darkness, or another way of saying that is ignorance requires the ongoing tenacious grasping after our fabricated views and insisting that they're real, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And I'll get into that in a little deeper. The Buddha's words continued, understanding not self uproots conceit. It uproots eye-making. When fully established, release is complete. Again, what are we talking about? Release from the fabricated views that are mentioned here. A misunderstanding of self in relation to an impermanent world. My words. Impermanence is an essential concept of the Dhamma. Impermanence, anicca, describes the environment in which unhappiness and stress arises and is maintained. Once we recognize and abandon that environment, no longer cling to that environment, stress simply vanishes. It's not a secret. We maintain stress by craving and clinging. All things in the phenomenal world are impermanent, and all events are uncertain as to occurrence, effect, and duration. In that way, we don't really know anything about what's going to occur next, can we? As human beings, we develop a reasonable understanding of how to plan our lives out and make plans for the next moment, the next day, the next year. And that's not being stuck in the future. That's simply being a wise human being, because we know more than likely the next moment will occur. So let's prepare ourselves for it. But we prepare ourselves for it from an awakened point of view. In other words, in this moment, I'm no longer I-making. I'm no longer stuck in conceit because I understand. And so I'm incapable of projecting that foolishness into the next moment or the next week or the next year or the rest of my life. In this moment, I have developed a Dhamma. I've reclaimed my mind, and I will no longer create fabricated, painful experiences for myself because of that understanding. When that issue is resolved, the not-self-characteristic, its environment that it's living in, and the resulting stress and suffering known as dukkha that follows from that misunderstanding, once that's resolved, I'm an awakened human being, as far as the Buddha is concerned. That's his whole Dhamma. Again, that's what we're working on here. We're trying to develop a profound understanding of what we are. Not just a way that masks a view of self that we begin establishing in inadequacy. There's something missing in me. There's something wrong with me. I need to acquire things constantly to establish myself in the world and to make my life worthwhile. And some people see that, and some people see it as power. Some people see it as social position. Some people see it as how many friends they have. I still remember back in high school when you start making friends, you tend to count how many friends you have, don't you? And you might even tell other people, you know, I got 16 friends, and, well, I got 17. And I heard that she has 18. Well, she's better than me. It's all foolishness, isn't it? Because none of that can change the six properties that make up every human being. And when we can understand that, it does not mean how many friends or how little friends we have. It doesn't matter how big the pile of gold is or how small the pile of gold is that's in our backyard. None of it matters. Why? Because none of it can be self. Why attach ourselves to things that we can't be? Why describe ourselves through impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas that have nothing to do with those six properties? Even our view of self changes moment by moment, doesn't it? So even though in this moment I am sure of what I am, something happens in the next moment. I hear something, somebody says something, I trip, I do something foolish, and now I'm back judging myself again. Usually very harshly, usually in a way that only reinforces that initial view that there's something missing or wrong with me. And when that is the motivation for our lives, there can only be stress and suffering. Even as we start looking to better ourselves, that bettering of ourselves is rooted in a fabricated view, isn't it? That there's something initially wrong with me, which is why I have to better myself. That's why that thought that there's something missing or broken in me leads to the thought that I need to self-actualize, as Abraham Maslow said many years ago. And remember Abraham Maslow in the 60s and 70s. But we're all doing that. We all think that there's something wrong. We all think that if I'm successful, you know, that's one of the big traps, that in order to have a meaningful life, I have to have some type of success, which is also an arbitrary and fabricated view, isn't it? And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive to have food. The Buddha said every human being needs four things. We need food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. And we do. And there's no I-making involved in procuring those for our moment-by-moment, day-to-day lives. It's when we start creating identities over the food that I eat, the big house that I have, the fancy clothes that I'm wearing, or the special medicine that I can get that nobody else can afford. Now we're in trouble, aren't we? Because now we're clinging to the basic things that every human being needs about life, and we're creating a view that that's me, that I am my house, my clothes, my medicine, et cetera, et cetera. When any reasonable human being who had the right view to see it would simply see those things as a consequence of having a human life. There's nothing personal about it. Impermanence, not self, and stress are the three linked characteristics of life in the phenomenal world. Impermanence, not self, and stress are also known as the three marks of existence. Understanding these three concepts is developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path. That's the reason why the Buddha taught us an Eightfold Path, to provide the framework and guidance so that we can mindfully and accurately observe this process going on within us. Again, remember, it's an internal process that we are putting ourselves through. It's not something that the world is doing to us. It's not something that's happening to us because of a misstep of birth or that we don't have enough smarts, or we don't have the right teachers, or we don't have the right Dhamma, or we don't have the right hair or the right color, et cetera, et cetera. The Buddha taught a Dhamma that any human being could engage in and develop to its completion. The only trick to that is we actually have to do it. But I can tell you from sitting here and being a part of this Sangha, your Sangha, that it works. And that's what we talk about all the time, don't we? How the Dhamma is manifesting in our lives, and our discussions are almost always on just what we're talking about tonight. How we are developing the Dhamma and how we are seeing ourselves now in relationship to the Dhamma and seeing our lives in relationship to the Eightfold Path. It's remarkable and it's unique. What is perceived as a self is simply an ego personality that has arisen from certain conditions known as the 12 links of dependent origination. We're going to get into that in 2 weeks, so I won't talk much about that. But I will say, dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to, and it simply states that from ignorance, a very specific ignorance, it's ignorance of these Four Noble Truths, through 12 observable causative links or occurrences, through 12 observable occurrences, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The reason why that is so significantly important, and the teachings on dependent origination are perhaps the most corrupted in modern Buddhism. It's given all kinds of ridiculous names, such as interdependence or interconnectedness or interbeing, and none of those relate to the word dependent. Forget about dependent origination. They just don't. But they're convenient because they allow us to continue eye-making within a so-called spiritual practice. Again, we'll get into this more in a couple of weeks. The ego personality is the form arisen from wrong view, a view that is ignorant of Four Noble Truths, and maintained by clinging to those views. The Buddha describes the ego self as anatta to show that what is perceived to be a self is not a self, and that the belief in a permanent and substantial self is rooted in ignorance, including the belief in a permanent non-physical self is just as wrong a view as a permanent physical self. Does everybody know what I'm talking about when I say that? A permanent non-physical self? What do I mean when I'm saying that?
The soul.
The soul. The most pernicious and hurtful belief is that belief that I have a soul. And sometimes that's characterized in modern Buddhism as a ground of being or an inner Buddha nature or a Buddhahood that resides within me. And I remember for many, many years when I was studying in the Mahayana and Theravada traditions, I would hear that and I'd always have this, like this gnawing thought in the back of my head. If I'm chasing this inner Buddha nature or an inner Buddhahood, how did that inner Buddha nature or Buddhahood get so screwed up in the first place? How? And that next thought led to this thought. Why would I chase something that is so prone to corruption? And it didn't make sense. I kept going and I kept grasping after, I kept ignoring that and grasping after fabricated concepts because I was told this is Buddhism until I finally got so frustrated with all of it. I said, a human being, an awakened human being could not possibly have taught something like this. And as I started to learn what the Buddha taught, there's one thing that he cautions against over and over and over and over again in his teachings. And we talk about it often here. To avoid speculating about yourself in any way, in any manner, including the belief that you can establish yourself in some kind of non-physical realm, whether it's through simple belief or good works, meaning manipulating the phenomenal world. There's one practice that I took my vows in many, many years ago teaches that you must do 108,000 full prostrations. That means from a standing position, you lay completely on the floor, you touch your head. Usually they'll teach you to raise your hands up and you stand up. That's one. You do that 108,000 times, and then you can begin your Dharma practice. And I took my vows in that particular lineage, and I quickly disavowed them. There's nothing in that, is there? It's just a ritual. In fact, it's a mindless ritual. It doesn't lead to any understanding. How can I understand anything about myself except that I'm foolish if I do that 108,000 times? And I'm not putting down the religion that practices that. For me, that would be the most foolish thing in the world. And I would only do it because someone told me to do it. And they told me to do it that if I did it, I would get something out of it. And so for someone to tell me that you're going to get enlightenment out of doing that is the same as getting you're going to get a box of Baby Ruth if you do it. It's all grasping after, isn't it? Even though one goal is a little bit more acceptable in so-called spiritual circles than a box of Baby Ruth, it's still the same thing. It's still grasping after something that I think I need to add to me to make me right. The Buddha said that's all nonsense. He said, resolve the issue, the misunderstanding of who you are and the misunderstanding of the world you live in, and you will release yourself from all fabricated views. The wisdom developed through the Eightfold Path ends ignorance of impermanence, not self, and stress. Dependent origination, that's my comment, I'm going to skip over that, sorry. Not self has been misinterpreted to mean that the self is nothing or a void or a void, and has led some to seek experiences of nothingness or emptiness. Not self simply means that what is commonly viewed as self is impermanent and insubstantial. Again, how could anything that's impermanent, remember from the Anatthalakkhana Sutta, if it's impermanent, how could it be me? Excuse me. Does everybody understand that? What were you going to say, Kevin?
I said it can't for 200, Alex. It's a Jeopardy joke.
Why is that true? Why is it true that if it's impermanent, it can't be a self? I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but does anybody question that?
Because you can't be satisfied by something that's impermanent.
Yep. You can't establish anything impermanent, can you? I'm 64 years old. This moment is a completely new moment to everything about me. Everything. So is this one. Oh, this one too. This one too. We know that. In that moment, from this moment to the next moment, millions of selves have come alive in this body. And a millions of selves has died away. Each and every one of us is an ongoing experience of impermanence. And as the Buddha teaches here, when we completely understand that, we have brought our minds back into our bodies, we have learned a way to keep them there as our point of reference, and then life is simply a matter of letting it unfold moment by moment. And in that way, when in this moment, remember the Bahia Sutta, many of us do, I won't teach it right now. When there's no me in this moment, no self-referential me, I'm alive. The Buddha likens living a life rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths as the death-like state. This is where, again, where the misunderstanding that the Buddha was teaching some kind of generational rebirth. He wasn't. He was reminding us to be careful about what we're giving birth to in this moment, and we'll talk about that in week 9. The views that I hold of myself in this moment, in relation to the world, or not, the views that I hold of myself in this moment determines the experience of this moment for me. And if my views are rooted in reality, meaning as described as Four Noble Truths, then this is a calm and peaceful moment no matter what's occurring. That relates directly to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, doesn't it? To notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind. An awakened human being, the word that's often used, has a mind at resting in equanimity, meaning that no matter what occurs, that mind remains calm and at peace. Why? Maybe a better question is how? The how is through the Dhamma. That's what we develop. We learn to depersonalize that most intense and personal existence of conceit in the world. This is me. It's not. So the question arises, if it's not you, what is it? If all the views that I've had about myself were wrong and don't constitute a self, who's teaching you right now? A better question is, who's teaching you right now from the perspective of the teacher? Does anybody have an answer for that?
Dhamma.
Very, very close. It really is the answer, but it's not the answer I wanted. Matt's got 99% of it. I'll give you the last little bit because we all want to go home sometime tonight. All right, you got to stay here till you get it. It's the Dhamma coming through the six properties. That's the only difference between me now and me, I could say 5 minutes ago, but certainly a few years ago when my whole existence was clinging to a vodka bottle or a bag of pot or something, which was, or something else to be different about myself. And that's what we're developing. We're developing just this. There's no self in this moment because there's no need for a self in this moment. A self can only cause confusion, delusion, and ongoing stress and disappointment. When there is no self needing things to be different than they are, meaning more of something or less of something, or bored by the lack of something new, an ambiguous way of looking at life. Another way of saying it is usually it results in melancholy and sometimes even severe depression. Being free of all of that and simply being, living in this moment from the perspective of right view, meaning everything that I see is depersonalized. Everything I see is meaningful because it's depersonalized. Do you see? Do you understand why? Why is everything meaningful? Because I've depersonalized it. Michael, you have your hand up?
Yes, I do. Because in that moment that you're speaking of, the mind unites with the body. And in those
yes.
moments of equanimity, the mind is united with the body.
Yes, and I'm not attaching that to something else.
Exactly.
I can see what's occurring clearly because there's no me fogging my view of what's occurring.
Dispassion also arises.
Including other people. It's often taught that the Buddha had some magical powers of clairvoyance and he could read people's minds. But he couldn't, and he never claimed to be able to do so. In fact, he said chasing after those kind of powers was just another distraction as well. But he was so well concentrated and mindfully present with another human being that he could understand them immediately. He understood what they needed in this moment. It was always the Dhamma coming from Siddhartha Gautama. And I bet you many of you would say you've had that experience of understanding people so much better simply because you're more present for them. But the reason why you're more present for them, for others, is because you're more present with yourself. That's a sometimes unnoticed effect of deepening concentration. Because what are we concentrating? We're concentrating our own mind. We are truly uniting our mind and our bodies, for many of us, for the first time in our lives. And there's such incredible power. And I'm not talking about the power to succeed in the physical world, although you'll likely be a better whatever you are by developing the Dhamma. But your vision of what is successful in this world will change drastically once we truly take refuge in the Dhamma. Because success, as defined by the Dhamma, is simply a calm and peaceful mind that understands stress and suffering. Does anybody think that they can't develop that understanding? Honestly, is there anyone here that doesn't think they can understand in a profound way the nature of stress in these three marks of existence? There is nothing that's difficult about this, is there? It takes time, it takes effort, and it takes the right but very simple Dhamma. And a Dhamma is just a word for saying, this is how to do it. This is the truth of Four Noble Truths. This is how you develop that understanding. That's how you develop the understanding that the sky is blue is nice, but it has no bearing on me. What I need to know is, what the hell is this six-property person? And how do I live in the world? With understanding. Anything is better when you understand it, isn't it? Playing Monopoly, you're much better at Monopoly when you understand the rules, don't you? Life is the same way. In the Eightfold Path are the rules for living.
What are the six properties, John?
The six properties are the four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. The fifth property of the space property, and that sixth property of consciousness or thinking. And it's important to say that when I say consciousness within the Buddhist Dhamma is not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's not consciousness with a big C. It's in the context of the Buddhist Dhamma, it's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, consciousness. Not self is an impermanent and insubstantial view that must be abandoned. Having arisen with an impermanence, the ego self has the characteristics of impermanence. It's always changing, isn't it? Not self is what is subject to the distraction of dukkha and perpetuating delusion. It is the establishment and maintenance of the ego self that continues stress and suffering. Impermanence also allows for the ego self to be extinguished and the distraction of stress brought to an end. Excuse me. That points to the third noble truth. Cessation of this process is possible. If it wasn't for the impermanence of our views, we wouldn't be able to extricate ourselves from those views, would we? Once a decision has been made about who I am, we'd be locked into it. But of course, the Buddha describes all of those views and even hardened concepts about self as like foam on the ocean. There's nothing to that. And when we start examining them through right view, the framework of the Eightfold Path, we start seeing them as completely insubstantial. We start seeing them as simply our ideas, and they're wrong-founded ideas. They're not based on anything, so they are truly like foam on the ocean. And as we recognize them as such, it avoids the compulsive self-referential need to analyze ourselves endlessly. Where did this thinking come from? Where did this conditioned way of looking at, where did all this fear come from? Where did all this come from? How do I explain myself? Well, you can't, and you don't have to. All that you have to do is to bring your mind into your body and keep it there. And then you're living. And you're living your life moment by moment. We started this by saying when you understand impermanence, you understand the Dhamma. You understand yourself in relation to impermanence. Impermanence also allows for the ego self to be extinguished and the distraction of stress brought to an end. Views of self leading to suffering are formed due to a lack of understanding. Another word for that is ignorance. Developing understanding, developing wisdom, ends unhappiness and stress. It is clinging that perpetuates the ego self. It is the ego personality's preoccupation with stress that perpetuates clinging and continues disenchantment and unhappiness. I'm going to stop there. That last sentence, the ego personality's preoccupation with stress that perpetuates clinging and continues disenchantment and unhappiness. The Buddha could have almost as accurately described the first noble truth as there is dukkha as saying there is the preoccupation with dukkha, because it is the ongoing preoccupation with me always getting what I think I need in this moment, or avoiding what I hope to avoid in this moment, or simply being bored out of my skin because there's not those two components going on in this moment, is the problem. That preoccupation is the constant distraction from what's actually occurring right now. And where is that preoccupation occurring? It's occurring within that mind rooted in I-making. It's why I'm preoccupied with stress and suffering. It's why I'm distracted by always grasping after what I think I need in this moment or what I think I need to avoid in this moment. And when I do that for 64 or 100 years or even for 5 minutes, I've lost my life, haven't I? I've lived my life for what's coming next and what I hope to avoid next, rather than being able to appreciate, mindfully appreciate, and be mindfully present for right here, right now. And that brings us where we resolve this issue of not self in relation to the world. It's right here and right now. The Dhamma can only be practiced in a mind united with its body. The Dhamma can only be practiced in the present moment. That's why we use jhana meditation on a regular basis, twice a day, because that brings our mind into our body. And as we continue to do that, in that moment, in that meditation practice, through those first three foundations of mindfulness, being mindful of the breath in the body, being mindful of feelings arising and passing away, and being mindful of thoughts arising and passing away in a dispassionate way, in that moment, we have brought ourselves back into our bodies where the Dhamma can be practiced. And then off our cushions, we're able to maintain a measure of that concentration and start employing the things that we learned. such as how to frame and understand what's occurring when my mind becomes agitated or distracted in some way by a worldly event. And we learned how to recognize that through right speech, right action, right livelihood, or its counterpart, wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. We learned just last week that if we find ourselves engaged in wrong speech or a wrong action or actions or an ongoing expression of wrong livelihood, that we've lost our mind. And that's as far as we need to go. We take a breath, we come back into this moment. And the compulsion towards that type of thinking is interrupted in that moment that we take that breath. And it's further, and we take it further along towards abandonment by continued Dhamma practice. The Dhamma is practiced in this moment at the point of contact with what's occurring. The time we spend developing jhana, developing concentration, is there to support what's occurring right here and right now. There's no Dhamma in the past because there's no me in the past. There's no Dhamma in the future because there's no Dhamma in the future. The Dhamma is right here, right now, because that's where I am. That's where I can practice. That's today's talk. I keep looking at Frank's living room, but not no Frank. Frank, are you there? Hey, Frank, can you hear me? Jane, how are you tonight?
Hi, John. Well, I'm sitting in my comfy chair.
Me too.
Right now, I feel peace.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you for your teachings that allow me to have these moments. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. It's well worth the price of admission, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Thanks, Jane. I wonder what happened to Frank, anyway. Amy.
Gosh, you're good.
I got lucky.
Yeah. I guess I want to say thank you. It's just a pleasure to be here and so much to reflect upon and to, one thing that did strike me is the stress that we bring. You had talked about when we are there for ourselves, we can be with other people more fully. It hit me again that when I'm feeling my stress, I'm also creating that for other people as well.
Yeah.
So thank you for that reminder.
Thank you, Amy. And when you're ending it in yourself, you're ending it for other people too. I mean, that's really how the Dhamma can bring peace on earth. I don't know that it will, but at least we can contribute our part to it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And please don't be overwhelmed by it. It does seem like there's a lot to learn, but it's just about, you hear me say it all the time, be very gentle with yourself and the Dhamma, and it will unfold. Everyone here, including me, started not knowing. And it's just by participating in it and doing what you're doing. I'm glad you joined us tonight. Matt, how are you tonight?
John, good to be here. Good to see everyone. This is really awesome to see all these folks here and sit with everybody. So thank you.
Thank you. Lorna.
I think it's just hit me tonight that not only have I to see myself as just six properties, but see everybody else as just six properties as well. Yeah. And as I carry around my conditioned thinking of which I've taken from the environment that I found myself in, that's what everybody else is doing, and that's what I see in other people's characters. And that's a big topic to get your head around. Thank you.
But, and it's part of our understanding, isn't it? We aren't any different from each other, and we can't be. And when you really understand that, you stop striving to be.
Mm.
Stop striving to be something that we can't possibly be. Now, of course, we can acquire certain positions or situations that, practically speaking, make us different from other people. I have 10 and you only have 5. But when we understand through the Buddha's Dhamma, that doesn't change who I am, does it? It just means I'm a six property person with 10 and you have 5. Where's the distinction? The distinction would be in something that is completely impermanent and completely meaningless, except the meaning that we give it. that 10 is better than 5? Where does it come from? Who came up with the notion? It's fabricated. Hello, Ken.
Hi, John. Really nice to be here with everybody. Thanks for this teaching, John. I think that, as much as you covered tonight, I think there's some levity to it that, you know, all we're really letting go of is they're just wrong views. It's not that big a deal. It's really, you know, when you really start to have the experience and calm your mind down and what do you do with wrong views? You learn why they're wrong and then you let them go. So it's a pretty simple, straightforward practice for the rest of your life. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, the Buddha.
Thank you. And why are they wrong views?
Because they're rooted in ignorance of four noble truths.
That's it. That's all we have to know. And to recognize those views. And how do we do it? We weigh them against the Eightfold Path. Does it fit in to the right aspects of the Eightfold Path? Thanks, Kevin. Hello, Rob.
Hello, John. I'm much less confused as I used to be about this specific thing here, the three marks. It takes a while to penetrate that. But it also hang together really well. And once it comes easily, once the understanding comes, applying it is as simple as pie.
Thank you. And it does take time, but that's all. Yeah. That's all. I mean, that Ram is such a good example of Dhamma practice. You know, and now you're reaping the benefits. And you were reaping the benefits when you didn't realize you were reaping the benefits. Because you were engaged in right effort. You know, developing the Dhamma. Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Good to see our Sangha growing.
Mm.
It's wonderful. If I boil it down to... your ego is not yourself. That seems to be the simplest, clearest way for me to perceive this. And channeling Frank, he brought the great statement, your ego is not your amigo. And that's an easy one to share.
You hear that, Frank?
So thank you, Frank.
He's not there.
See, our trademark on that.
Thank you, Helen.
We can sell shirts with that, John.
The ego is not your amigo.
I
prefer Liz's.
What's Liz's?
You say it wrong.
Anatta. Anatta me.
You sounded just like my crazy Uncle Jimmy when I said that. That's great. Tim, did this bring a little bit more clarity?
I there's a couple of things that, with all due respect to this, I disagree with on some. I don't want to oversimplify. I don't think this should be oversimplified, and this is why, because we talked about this briefly on Saturday. You know, if we were living a life with very little amount of entanglements, yes, we can recognize wrong view, quickly abandon them, and have a mind of equanimity and be peaceful. But unfortunately, we don't. Or, again, everybody's different because it's introspective. Everybody has their own world that they're going through. So I try not to I don't want to say that it's easy. What might be easy for me, maybe almost like climbing a huge mountain for others. That being said, this is the part of the structured class that I was looking forward to, but also apprehensive, I mentioned to you, and because of impermanence. I'll just quickly read what I feel about these things. We cannot control the impermanence of the world or control its movement. thus to cling and crave to that which is not in our control can only cause a state of agitation. And since everything in the universe is impermanent, to self-identify with anything in this world can and will eventually lead to dissatisfaction and dukkha.
So what was hard about that?
It's understanding it isn't hard. Applying it is. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because of conditioned thinking and entanglements. Mm-hmm. And that's the bugaboo. I do have an ego, but detaching from it and being dispassionate, not to react to it, is where I find the peace and tranquility arise.
Yeah.
Not reacting, being dispassionate, using the Dhamma, using the Eightfold Path to practice the Dhamma, all that is in our control are the three factors of the Eightfold Path, especially the virtuous factors. So we have control over our thoughts and feelings through right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So that's a lot. And so that's the practice I'm trying to incorporate on this lesson on the three marks of existence. So I thank everybody in the Sangha. It's incredibly informative and profound to be part of it, and to get the insight from everybody.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. And I would say you're doing it exactly as it's taught, and you're developing it as intended. And I think what Ram was referring to, what I'm referring to too, once you have, and it's why I teach the way I teach, which I learned from reading how the Buddha taught, is always teaching in the context of the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. And so once you develop that context, when you understand where the Buddha is coming from, then you can start applying it. And it is easy at that point. Mm-hmm. It always seems difficult and much harder than it is when we're clinging to old views and trying to incorporate new views. And whether that was through a Dhamma practice or simply two competing philosophies, you would have the same kind of tension, trying to fit two contradictory views. And so the Buddha was the most radical thinker of humans have ever seen. And so everything he teaches is contradictory to the way we want to see the world. And that's the difficulty. But as we learn, all of that is like foam on the ocean. It simply cannot withstand us knowing the truth. It falls away. Thank you.
But he did say, his last words were, strive diligently for your awakening.
Yep.
He did point out that it's going to take effort.
Those were his last words. Yeah, that's what we need to do. Thank you, Tim. Eva.
I'm not going to pretend everything's clear to me yet. I still feel like a newbie. But at the same time, it all makes sense. Like, it's a strange feeling. Like, you're coming into something that you are aware of, but you don't practice, but you really want to. But you're a wealth of knowledge. So is everybody else. So I'm really grateful for being here. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's how it was for me when I finally started studying what the Buddha taught. This has got to be it. Mm-hmm. And it is. Glad you joined us. Good evening, David.
Well, John, we all come to this room for different reasons. And it's a big elephant to get a handle on. But really it comes down to understanding. And the structure of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path is the means.
Yep.
And then it's your effort, and it's your understanding that it's for the long haul. This isn't something that gets fixed and then you move on. This is your life. This is how you conduct yourselves. Yep. And then it becomes an easy path because you start abandoning these weighty things that were holding you down. And there's a clarity in the insight that this is all about. The three marks that this is all about is the insight. So thank you for teaching.
Well said. Thank you, David. Anna, how are you tonight?
Great.
Good.
Thank you, everyone. I just want to say thank you, John. And foremost, I want to say thank you, Matt, because I found out about this class because Matt, and what he said was, there's one word he said, it was incredible. He said, we're just breath. And I thought, okay, I want to find out what he means by that. So I came. And that was about 2 weeks ago. And I think it's difficult as it is, it's simple. And it just, it's breathing. There's no mistakes, no harshness in breathing. And that's why you always say be gentle, because when we breathe, we're being gentle. That's a great beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think, for me personally, I need to be mindful of everything being more and being less, and to let go and not to cling on to things that doesn't define who I am, because this I'm making is just exhausting. It's exhausting, and raising two kids are not, I don't need any more high making. So, thank you.
Again, well said.
Less exhausted.
Thank you, Anna. That's great. Mark, how are you tonight?
Right now, I'm sad. I lost a friend today. Lost a lot of people in the last year. So impermanence has been. But kind of noticing that some attachment to grief, and I guess for me, I'm allowing myself to experience the grief, so in that way, not be attached. And throughout the week, there's been a lot of noticing, and a strange sense of being almost in a dream all the time. But a dream in which I'm both inside myself and outside myself. Like I've been noticing this, like there was as if there was this glass that came down here and then went this way. So as the glass begins to dissolve and I'm going deeper into my belly and body, I notice that the glass begins to dissolve and I'm starting to feel more present with whatever is there, whether it be music. And I sort of been to work. Maybe to articulate, I feel like I've been experiencing the space between stimulus and response. And so I feel like I haven't been as reactive this week, and I've allowed myself to choose within that gap or space. It's been that dreamlike feeling. In some ways, I feel like I was on the pillow tonight, I felt like, am I ready to die here? And I didn't know what I meant when I heard that voice, and then it kind of drifted away. But I was in a lot of kind of discomfort, and I said, yeah, but why don't you just, he said 5 more minutes, and I said, you know what, I could be here for 10 years or 200 years or 1,000 years. I don't know, just so many things have happened. So it's been an extremely rich time since I was here last Tuesday. I'm enjoying the dreamlike element of it because I feel in some strange way that the dream is coming awake. I'm sort of seeing the, you know, like everything's kind of atoms and stuff, and I'm just seeing everything, not in a psychedelic way, but just in a sense of everything is kind of living that sense of impermanence. And also out of that has come a lot of pleasure. Simplest things And he said the other day, what are you doing? I found the doorknob. What are you doing looking at the doorknob? I said, well, I'm just enjoying the doorknob. I like the shape and everything about it. I said, oh, I thought you were worried about the coronavirus.
I didn't touch the doorknob.
So anyway, it's thank you for opening a lot of doors this week. Appreciate it.
Thank you for engaging and opening the doors. Sometimes, as we start deepening our concentration and becoming more in our bodies for longer periods of time, I would say noticeable periods of time, life can feel like that because you're literally of two minds at the same time. And so you can have that feeling that you've lost your equilibrium in this moment. And that's just part of the process. It's good that you recognize it and don't let it dissuade you. And the other thing, feeling grief when someone dies is what we should do as human beings. In other words, the feeling is not wrong. And it's not necessarily self-referential. It's when, as we develop the Dhamma, in the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, which means that every thought is an appropriate thought. And so when we hear of a loved one passing away, the most appropriate human thought and feeling is grief, isn't it? And it's not a grief that insists that things be different or that we're blaming situations for our grief. In other words, you know, God should have never taken that person, or you know, whatever it might be, whatever scenario we create in our minds as an aspect of aversion towards grief, rather than just feeling grief. And I think that's what you're doing. It's very poignant, and that when I say that the Dhamma makes each moment meaningful is because we can feel grief or sadness or anger in the moment, because that's what it is. That's what's occurring in this moment. Yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
I just feel like I've been grieving myself, and wondering whether it was a form of disguised violence of trying to extract myself and. Because I felt like that was, you know, and then that would dissolve, and I would just be in the moment and not even feel that. I felt like something was dying in me, and I don't know whether it was. I think it's a lot of things. I think a lot. It's form of grieving, and also noticing the attachment to grieving, and at the same time. I think I've had more joy this week, ironically, but maybe it sort of works in that dance of having those deep feelings, and then they pass on, and then all of a sudden, whether it's a doorknob or it was the sixth Brandenburg Concerto, and I was in the car, and I'm going like, well, I got to get to work, and I didn't. I sat for 15 minutes, and I touched my face, and it was covered with tears, and the music was just fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was just as good as the doorknob.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Yeah, I my advice to you is continue. Thanks. Bill, how are you? Welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you very much. I'm just grateful to be here. I have another place in which I practice some spiritual principles in my life. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 12-step fellowship.
Well, I know that group well.
Yeah. I imagine some might. I'm pretty much I'm here looking to do a little bit of a deeper dive on the spiritual aspect, but I'm noticing a lot of the same principles that were, I imagine, borrowed from Buddhism. So grateful that they were there to be borrowed. It's not it's simple but not easy.
Yeah.
You know. I don't know. I'm just looking to do a little bit of a deeper dive and see what there is out there. So I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. Welcome to our Sangha. Have you been to the Becoming-Buddha website? On there are guided meditations from 5 to 45 minutes that are just like what we did here. So you could download those and listen to them. If you're just starting a practice or reinvigorating a practice, I suggest just start with 5 or 10 minutes at a time. And if you can do that twice a day, very quickly you'll have an effective jhana practice. And then keep coming to class and you'll learn the Dhamma just like we all have. So, again, cool. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Thank you for asking. I'm doing good.
Thank you. Still digesting a bit. I mean, you hit everybody pretty much square in the eyes with the ego and self. I, too, practice another spirituality practice, and definitely lines up with this idea that, you know, self-centeredness is the root of all of our issues.
Yeah.
And I love this idea of attachment and clinging to impermanence in life, because right now in my life, I'm in, someone told me I felt like I got flipped upside down, but maybe it was flipped upside right. I don't know. but there's some impermanence, and something that I thought was definitely permanent, left. And shockingly, I have the tools, in a sense, to, walk through this thing and be okay. And I understand that any feeling, emotion, thought is not necessarily me. They're pretty much meaningless and flutter into the ether, as long as I let them. I hear a lot of people sharing about it's simple, but it's hard. And I agree with that, but I also agree it's as hard as we make it.
Yeah.
So the only reason it's hard is because we hold on to it so hard. And, the ego and the self and everything else, I have these thoughts in my head of just like something, like some crazy monster just willing to cling on to anything and everything. Just looks for this little crack of, whatever impermanence, and it crawls back in, it jumps back into our life at any given time. And, you have to become aware of it, and you have to take actions the other way. So with that, I also hear things about practice, and I have a small question. Other than gaining knowledge and coming to class, and, I can recite the book from, other spiritual teachings that I've got, but it does me no good just to have the knowledge.
Yep.
So other than meditation, what are the action and practice, just applying it in your life, on a daily basis? When you say actual practice, what are the actions?
Yes, it's all that. It rests on a jhana practice, on a meditation practice.
Okay.
And from that increasing concentration, we are able to actually hold in mind the things that we're learning. The intellectual exposition of the Dhamma. And once we do that, which it just takes coming to class a little bit and a little bit of reading, then we can learn how to apply those teachings through the framework of the Eightfold Path. That series, how long have you been coming, Mike? Is this your second or third class?
Second week.
So last week we were talking about, we were talking about concentration. The week before that was right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. And by having a little bit more concentration and inclining our minds to be mindful of our speech, our action, and our livelihood allows us to practice the Dhamma then. So in other words, if I find me and you are hanging out and I start gossiping about someone, I know that that's right speech because I now have the framework to say, wait a minute, I don't want to do that anymore. And I simply practice restraint at that moment. That's Dhamma practice in that simple and direct way. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't mean anything, does it? That in this moment, I'm not engaging in gossip. But to me, developing the Dhamma, that's the most significant thing that I can do at this moment, is to not do that. That's Dhamma practice. When I start sitting in my own stuff, wanting my life to be different, or another person in my life to be different, now I have the Dhamma to recognize, wait a minute, that's the essence of eye making. I don't want to do that anymore. That's Dhamma practice. So it is just that practical. The reason why we need the Dhamma is we don't know enough to do that ourselves. You think we would be, but we're not, because of something called conditioned mind. Our minds are actually conditioned away from seeing what's actually occurring in our life. That's the essence of ignorance.
John,
and these are the great realizations that the Buddha came to when he awakened. He understood that key problem of ignorance. Yes, Helen.
I just wanted to add that as the more that you practice this, the more it is reflected, and people start to respond to you differently. So it has a ripple effect. And sometimes, it's astounding when you realize the impact it's having on the people around you. That's when you feel how powerful this is.
Yeah.
It's not something you're necessarily intending to manipulate someone, but just your behavior, your speech, it sends off this other, it creates this wave that people will respond to. It can be very, very striking sometimes.
And encouraging.
Yes.
Please pass if you'd rather not be put on the spot, but could you give us an example of how that's worked?
Well, I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. I was visiting a friend of mine who is in the declining months of cancer. And he is always the same. He's always happy to see you. He's always generous in his conversation. He's just this wonderful person. And just before I went down to visit them, something kind of disturbing happened in my life. And when I got down there, I mentioned what this was, but just as an aside, I had had 3 days to process it, so I was in a much better place. But, growing up the way I did, we use humor a lot in how we untangle things. And so later on in the day, Bob came up to me and said, that I was so amazing about how I was dealing with things. And my head almost whipped off my shoulders. I was like, but Bob, what I'm going through is nothing. What you're going through, and with such grace and poise and all. And so I didn't even realize that he was feeling that for me, because I'm always so aware of what I receive from him. So it kind of knocked me back on my heels that he could say that. But it's the benefit of this practice.
It is. Thank you, Helen. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I wanted to hear what you had to say. That's why I say the most loving thing, if we really care about the world and the people in this world and what's going on in this world, the most loving thing we can do is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And Helen, explain why. Because we do have a direct impact on the people around us. In fact, it's the only impact we can have. Again, think about that a little bit. As human beings, what other impact could we have on other human beings except to be a human being? It's the only thing that really matters in life. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, John. I'm going to take noble silence, but thank you to everybody and for being here.
I'm glad you're here. Hello, Liz.
Hello. It's good to be here with everyone. And I would say, the idea of being gentle with yourself is to maybe give yourself 3 days to get over something, to work through it. It takes as long as it takes.
Yeah.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Russ, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I was just going to say that I find it hard to live in the moment, and this helps a lot because I spend a lot of my time worrying about what happened during the day, especially at work. And what's going to happen tomorrow?
Yep.
Funny thing is, I don't have control over any of that.
You don't?
And yet I'm ruining my moment.
Yes. But you recognize it.
Yeah. So, I want to not do that. Because I want to live in the moment. I want to enjoy my moment, not ruin it by thinking about tomorrow and all the troubles that could come. They may not come. So. Anyway, this helps a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Russ. I mean, you first have to recognize what needs to be changed, and that's what an Eightfold Path gives us, that framework to focus it, and then you can change it. I said this a few times. Alvin Toffler wrote in his book, I think it was Future Shock, that time is a good, no, that's not the right quote. Forget it. You're practicing the Dhamma at the point of contact, and that's how it's done. Thank you. Hello, Andrew.
Good evening, John. I thank you for the lesson. I will practice noble silence.
I'm glad you're here. Hello, Michael.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. The quality of mind seems like it's okay tonight. I feel good, which I think is extremely important.
It is.
It's something I kind of pay attention to. And I find that when my quality of mind is good and where it should be, I understand better the Dhamma. Okay? And you had said before, the Dhamma is practiced when the mind is united with the body. And that's what occurs, and that's what I've noticed, when my quality of mind is good. I realize that my mind unites with my body, and I'm in a peaceful, calm place. And I'm not distracted, and discord is not something that enters into this place. And when this occurs, I find myself to be non-reactive and dispassionate to the world around me. Mm-hmm. So, again, I thank you for mentioning that, most importantly, the fact that, you know, the Dhamma is practice when the mind is united with the body. I think it's an extremely important thing that you have said. I'm sure you've said it at least a dozen times since I've been here, and probably more than that, but this time I heard
633 times since June.
Okay, so a little off. But again, it seems like it's something that I understand, and helps me understand it, the Dhamma better also. So thank you.
Thank you, and you understand I you did start around June here, you and Julia, is that right? Past June?
Yeah.
And in a very, very short time, you've established seclusion and a calm and peaceful mind. And so that's why I say it's a simple and direct and not that hard of a path. If Michael can do it, anybody can do it. But you had no real experience before this, did you?
I did a little reading here and there, John. I had a sense of seeking, so to say, or finding something more than what was out there. And the first night Julie and I came here, we realized where we were. And from that point on, we just basically took to the material, we digested as we go through our lives, we seek, you know, a deeper understanding of it, and we, it's not only that we read, you know, we read, but we also put into play or practice any things that, these concepts that we, until they become part of our being, basically, until we understand fully, and it's actually, it's working for us, so.
Yeah.
It's not a finished product, but we're working for it.
You're both just great example of right effort, so thank you. Hello, Julia.
Hello, John. I wrote one of my usual summaries, so I'll just read it. I'll share it with everyone. This is my understanding of the three marks of existence. The three marks of existence is the description of the reality that everything is impermanent. It is the emergence of this ego personality in an environment of impermanence which causes suffering and confusion. Wisdom is understanding the interaction of the ego personality with the environment of impermanence and stress. This ego self seeks to establish and perpetuate itself by developing strong attachments to people, objects, events of the past or of the future. The understanding that everything we experience through our sixth sense base is impermanent is ungraspable and unknowable enables us to understand suffering. There are no moments, no experiences that are stable and unchangeable. Change is the only constant. Understanding the inherent unsatisfactoriness due to this intrinsic instability is the key. Suffering is not produced by this insubstantial nature, rather by our mind thinking that happiness could be attained through trying to keep and identify with things that are ephemeral. Now, I remember this quote that I always really loved. It's from a movie called Crouching Tigers, and I think in the House of Seven Daggers or something like that. It's an Oriental movie, of course. but it sounds, this one little quote sounds like the actual definition of the marks of existence. The things we touch have no permanence. There is nothing we can hold onto in this world. Only by letting go can we possess what is real. That's it, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm glad that somebody did their homework.
Yeah, I don't do my homework. It's just my nature.
Thank you, Julia. Did I get everyone? You're all kind of a blur, so that's why I asked the question. What a wonderful class. Well, the second half of this will be our Saturday class, and then I'll post that talk up too. But I encourage you to if you've missed any of our classes, to catch up on them, because the Sangha discussions this time through, they're always remarkable, but this time through this The Truth of Happiness study, it's really remarkable where you've all come from. Even those that are new, you're really getting this understanding.
After 663 times, something's got to stick.
Thank you, Helen. When I do that, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Excuse me. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.